live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting through our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. Today, the latest on health and healing, including how unemployment can cause you to be at greater risk of dying. That's serious. Also, I watched a segment from Joe Rogan's show last night that was sent to me and for my feedback. And I took a look at it, and my comments are going to be today. So for Joe Rogan and Candace Owens, a very popular conservative African-American woman who is all over the internet, and I'm going to share a message for Candace, one that I hope that she receives in the spirit of allowing her to walk away from misinformation that she's embracing and sharing with others on global warming. So heads up, if anyone knows Candace Owens or can send something to her, please take my commentary today and share it with her. In fact, if you could also share it with everyone who is a climate change denier, and there are many. In fact, probably half the American population, including almost everyone in the conservative Republican movement. So I'll be giving a shout out, but in a positive way to her, not to attack her for being wrong on these issues, but rather to help her see that if she really cares about the truth, as she claims she does, then hopefully she will approach the information I'm sharing with her and see that she's just been on the wrong side of this issue. And that is our show. Lots of information going to come your way today. And we begin with this study from the University of British Columbia. And it talks about, quote, unemployment is also a health policy, according to the University of British Columbia study that found that workers experiencing higher death rates if they didn't have access to social protections like unemployment insurance and unemployment benefits. Researchers with the Human Early Learning Partnership and the School of Population and Public Health at the university found that low and medium skilled workers in the United States are at greater risk of death if they lose their job and then counterparts who are working. Just a thought on this. I had the benefit of 7 years of filming Poverty Inc. And during that time, I interviewed over 1,000 individuals, some homeless living on the streets, but no one was born there, so how did you get there? I wanted them to tell me the story that led them to where they were, their current circumstances. And many people had been working. In fact, the majority of people that I interviewed who were on unemployment or their unemployment insurance went out, and they had no money to pay any bills, they were forced out into the street. First, that causes depression, apathy, loss of faith. A lot of people say if they believed in a God, they would say, where are you in my hour of need? Well, I could also say, where is everyone that's ever suffered when they needed a higher being to intervene? Or they play that game, well, you know, it works in strange ways. Be what it may, people suddenly have their faith challenged when things go all wrong, when there's no support system, family, friends, society, in effect, and the very people walking down the street to go to their jobs are walking right past you as if you're invisible. And that's what I was told by so many poor people. They felt invisible. And indeed, in our society, they are. In fact, I've lived in the same place since I came to New York City, same neighborhood. And there's a beautiful park, and it's on the Hudson River. And it runs from the George Washington Bridge clear down to Wall Street. And this place where you can run and walk. And there is, the police will go down there and tell the homeless people who are sleeping down there, get up, get out, don't be here. If you don't want to get a ticket or arrested, by 6 a.m. in the morning. Now, I've been down there. I've spoken with them. I've seen them lined in a long line, waiting at a water fountain, even in freezing weather so they can brush their teeth or shave, and they're patient, and they want to disappear so they don't get hassled anymore in what they did. So we take a person's down and out, and we then tell them, we don't want you depressing other people who live in an upscale neighborhood and therefore bring down the perception this is not a good neighborhood because poor people live here. How ironic. So if a person lives in the neighborhood, they go into a church or mosque or another place of worship, and they're taught to respect life, yet they don't respect the life that they live right across the street from. The hypocrisy is palpable. Anyhow, we could end all poverty and all suffering if we chose to. We have the resources. We just don't choose to, not at this time. So if you want to know why people are dying, try being unemployed. I'll give you one story, actually two stories. One was a gentleman that I met down in outside of Orlando. Actually, it was Cape Canaveral. And I was saying, where would you like to be filmed? He said, well, there's a building on the university campus, and I paid for it. There's two. One's a gymnasium, another's a science hall. So I took him over and I asked him to sit on the curb, and I got down the street and I filmed this shot where you see him, and then he disappears and you see this beautiful, big, you know, $50, $60 million building. He donated all that money when he was very successful. Now, the university won't even give him a room. A room. He said he gave him $100 million to stay in. And I thought, well, that's typical. Why should you be surprised? And he showed me where he was living. He was living in the garage of his former janitor. So how things juxtaposed and changed. And he said it's humbled him. All the people that he gave money to, organizations and foundations and grants. He was very, very philanthropic. But he didn't get out of the markets in time. He thought it would only be a little blip, and it wasn't. He lost everything. Till literally, he said, the day came when he was out on the street with one suitcase and no place to go. He had no money. And he said that's when he realized, wow. And he had a lot of warning signs. He just chose to be optimistic instead of realistic. Now let's jump back up to Harlem. A gentleman and his wife, I met him one night. I went out at night to film where people were living in the winter. And here on in a neighborhood, I found in a doorway a man and a woman. And they had blankets over them. They were in a doorway. And it was a building that was no one was living in, a brownstone. And so I interviewed him, and he and his wife had lived in a brownstone, had a basement apartment, had everything nice, quality of life. He was a super. And then the house burnt down. And no fault of theirs. And he got out with just his life, nothing. And he realized that he had no place to sleep that night, no food to eat, no shower to take, no place to bathe or go to the bathroom. He was literally on the street. And he was unprepared for it. And he said he went through a deep anxiety of, what do I do now? So I said, in all your years of living up in Harlem and you'd walk up and down the different streets, did you ever stop and befriend any of the homeless people? Did you ask them, friend, is there anything I can do? He said, no. I wasn't mean to him. I wasn't angry at him. I didn't pay any attention to him. And he said, now, my wife and I that night, we spent the night on a park bench, sitting on a bench near the park. Wow. Where do you go to the bathroom in the morning? How do you brush your teeth? None of this was he prepared for. So here's the larger lesson from this one study. When people think that when you're out of work or underemployed, even working and still homeless, which is common, or hungry, even though you might have one or even two jobs, because corporations are so inherently selfish with vulture capitalism that any money they do make, they want to go to those people who are most powerful in the corporation, including stockholders. The employees are irrelevant once you get out of management. So now we live in a completely unbridled, naked capitalism society. And we show the worst of ourselves, those who have money and those, unfortunately, who disdain those who do not. And so why wouldn't they be depressed? If you didn't know where your next meal is coming from, if you didn't know that your children would have food today, if you got your kid out of school today and you had to take him to a shelter or to your car, and then you know you'd be ticketed if you spent the night in your car with your kid, how would you feel about life, society? Your perception changes to the degree that you must maladapt to the society that you're still a part of. And yet, that society, with few exceptions, there are exceptions, don't care about you. In fact, depending upon where you live, they disdain you. So yeah, you're going to die quicker. The mechanisms of dying are relatively straightforward. Negative thoughts, anxious thoughts, insecure thoughts that are chronic 24/7 change our biochemistry and put us into a death cycle. It's just a matter of time. Now, following on that is, this is an article from The Hill. Now, this is a mainstream publication from Reed Wilson, quote, "More millennials living with parents. About a third of all millennials," that would be almost 25 million or so, "still live with and rely financially on their parents as a result of evolving social norms and fallout from the worst recession in generations. Younger Americans are increasingly putting off milestones like marriage, having a child, and buying a home as they pursue education and job opportunities, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. This shift from four decades ago, when more Americans viewed marriage and child rearing as gateways to adulthood. Those driving the change in priorities appear to be young women who are much more likely to get a college degree and a full-time job today than if they were in the 1976-77. On the other hand, young men are only slightly more likely to have attained a higher education and less likely to be employed. The number of young adults who live at home with their parents has skyrocketed in the last decade as college costs have soared and the Great Recession has hurt job prospects." And we're talking about 19.9 million still living, actually 22.9 million still living at home. Wow. Okay, a few perspectives on that. And then I would like your feedback. I'd like you to call in and share your points of view on the problem and the solution. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Here's my perspective. I've been sharing this number with you because it's an accurate number and no one in society is paying attention to it, but you really should look at the numbers. You have 17.2 million professionals, lawyers, scientists, engineers, professors, doctors, architects, etc. You have 10 million millionaires. These are careerists. Between them and their children, you're looking at 112 million people, or one-third of the entire American population. So let's just say that you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, you're an engineer, you're a professor. Your kid goes to a good school, maybe an Ivy League school, and comes home but can't find the job that they want or like or aligns with their education. So they stay home. They're going to wait. Now, what is the support system? They don't have to worry about rent. They don't have to worry about food. They don't have to worry about going out and buying anything because they get a credit card. They have been this way. Many of these people, not all, but probably the millionaire class, many of the professional class, have thought so much of their children's future that they hired tutors. Now think about this. Let's just slow it down and think of this. When you and I went to school, we had to pay attention, do our homework, act appropriate in class and out, or we failed. We were set back. And that would be an embarrassment, not just to us, but to our family. And so there were a lot of people who were invested in us acting in an appropriate manner with some sense of character. There were consequences to being crude, rude, vulgar, mean, angry, or acting as if nothing else mattered except what we wanted. Now ask yourself, how many of us were given tutors so we could get a better score to get into college? Today, it is absolutely common for wealthy individuals, either those who are millionaires without real estate or those who live like they're millionaires, though they're not the professional class, so they're always in debt. They want their kids to become valedictorians, and so they get tutors. Sometimes kids are tutored 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week in different areas. They put them into private schools, and that could easily cost $100,000 a year between the tutors and the classes. Then one day the child rewards the parents by showing that they were a perfect little adult and they graduate magna cum laude or the valedictorian, and everyone's proud of them. And they go off to college, and suddenly they meet a whole lot of them, thousands just like them. We forget, when you've got 100 million people all competing to increase the quality of their lifestyle, some by going up the careerist ladder and working hard and providing the standard of living, which does not equate quality of life, and the others who it doesn't matter what they do in life. They don't have to do a darn thing. They never have to worry about anything because mom and dad will always pick up the bill. So when we're talking about homeless people and people living at home, millennials, how many of those young millennials are from rich parents or professional parents who can act like they're rich? How many? Isn't that a reasonable question we should be asking in a society? Because I know a lot of working class people, their kids are not hanging out at home. Their parents have very high work ethics, and those kids are working. Now, they may not like the work, but they're working. They're doing what they can to provide some relief for their student debt and their home expenses. And I know some of the parents of those kids. And it doesn't mean their kids weren't smart. It means that everything was put into perspective. If the parent worked hard and was responsible, they expect the children to do the same. So, that said, now, who's most likely to die because they're poor, don't have a living income, don't have a quality of life, may be homeless, maybe have a home but no money to pay for all the things they need, may be burdened with debt collectors constantly harassing them, may they have their home broken into by SWAT teams saying that they owe bills? And those are not your rich, and those are not the professional class. They will never bear the burden of that responsibility to know what it is to be poor, unless there's exceptional circumstances. And when you see them, and the Kardashians are the best examples of that, not the only, but the best, and then other people want to model their greed, their self-centeredness, their uniquely narcissistic perspective, and bordering, in my opinion, on sociopathology, where they have absolutely disdain for everybody and everyone must take picture of them and then they must take picture of themselves. They must all get down and worship the picture they just took. That's how far down the rabbit hole of irrelevance to human nature we've gone. So, my thought for all of our policymakers in Washington and at the state capitals and in local communities, you can't help solve a problem till you really know the dimensions of it and who's suffering and to what degree. Then you can hopefully help them. Now, how would I suggest you help? I'll give you 3 good examples. 1, forgive all public school debt. 0. Wipe it out. So you give a person a chance to start life without being in debt peonage. Now, I can't say that about private education, because once you decide that it's a private education you want, then you're going into an elitist mindset. You're now engaged in identity politics because you want to go to a certain school, but not a school that teaches the same equivalency of quality information with equally qualified teachers, because you want the pedigree of having graduated from that. That automatically separates you. You've already started deconstructing your humanistic principles. I'm better because I attended this school. 2, that if as a society we stop hammering on the idea of the American dream is owning a house, it is not. There was a time following World War II where our parents came back from overseas and they wanted to start a life. They had just gone through 16 years of challenge, privations, and sacrifice between the Great Depression and World War II. 16 years. So they knew suffering. They knew what it was like to be on different types of rations. Now they wanted something better. And as a society, and in Europe through the Marshall Plan, we provided that. And we gave low interest 2% loans for people to buy a home, and they did go to college, and they did, frequently the first of their entire family lineage to go to college. So that was important. And they weren't looking to get rich, and they weren't looking to be millionaires. They were just looking to provide for a family. And over the next 30 years, the value of that house probably doubled. Normally, it's 1.5% to 2% increase per year until the stupidness of the 2000s when it would increase as much as 30% a year. But today, that's all changed. I would tell people, do not buy anything, because our society is nothing but massive bubbles. I've detailed it multiple times in this program. We have credit card bubbles and car loan bubbles, student debt bubbles, and federal expending bubbles, non-entitlement entitlement bubbles. We also have corporate bubbles, mortgage bubbles, and personal debt bubbles. Altogether, it's over $200 trillion. We are bankrupt. So it should not be a surprise that these bubbles are going to start to burst, some slowly, some rapidly. The last thing you want to do at this point in such an uncertain economy, that where income inequality is so radical that if you're not the rich, you are going to be the poor. So why would you indebt yourself? It makes no sense. So you do not have to own that. And thank goodness many of the more reasonable and responsible and good-thinking millennials say, no, I don't want a part of that. I don't need to show I'm arrived in adulthood by owning a house and having kids. We need kids to be adopted. We have 7 million orphan children. Let's adopt a kid, be a big brother, big sister. You don't have to prove your genetic capability of progeny. Look what you can do if you're not saddled to debt and living by their rules. Who benefits when you buy the house and have the marriage and the kids and what it's going to cost? All you're doing now for the next 20 years is just working to pay for the debt you've accumulated. Quality of life goes out the window for most. So I'm happy a lot of people are going the way of Walt Whitman and Thoreau and others who at the end of the age of reason decided austerity and quality of life go hand in hand. Excessive consumption, owning a lot of stuff, merely becomes a interlocking chain to deprive you of the freedom to express yourself and go and be in a world of wonderful cultures and people. So these are the lessons I believe that baby boomers should share with their children's and their children's children, and that millennials should not be depressed because they're not gaining traction as all other generations thought you had to do in order to show you're in this race of life. Step out of the race and realize that you should be looking not at living in a home, but rather going to intentional communities around the world and being a part of progressive movements for important change. Just my thoughts. And our talkback number is 888-874-4888, and I'd like to hear from you. Now, I'm going to play this short clip from Joe Rogan, who has a podcast, and Candace Owens, this conservative African-American woman, who is very popular in the conservative movement, who is articulate, but boy, is she on the wrong side of this issue. And it's not an attack on her. It's merely me being in the road, waving my hand, saying, Candace, please, you stop for a moment. Go off your Twitter account and just take a few days to do your homework. And I believe that you will not only change your views on global warming, but by extension, you'll start changing your views on a lot of other things that are tied into global warming denialism. Let's hear from Candace and her points of view.
I don't think we have to care about the environment.
Like, what do you... No, not even a little bit.
Not even a little bit?
No. Let me clarify this. I don't throw trash on the ground. Like, okay. I'm not saying we need to trash the environment. But do I believe in climate change? No.
You don't believe in climate change?
No. I think the climate always changes, I guess is what I should say. Do I believe that this is an issue that global warming, which they've changed conveniently. They got rid of the word. One scientist started disproving it. Now they only say climate change. No, I think that was just a way to extract dollars from Americans. I don't at all believe. They had no actionable plan. It was great for Trump to get out of that deal. It was terrible.
Okay, but this is an incredibly complicated subject.
Right.
And if you would have to talk to a bunch of different scientists,
right,
and see how they gather data and see what they understand about CO2 levels and what's the danger of them,
right,
and what can combat it and what could not. Have you done all this, or
no,
do you
so
take
think,
this flippant opinion
no,
it's,
based
it's, listen,
on the
I'm
party not,
line?
This is not. This wouldn't be the hill I died on, right? But it's not about the party. I just genuinely, I've read a ton about it, but
what
I would not be able to. I would not be able to come to you and say this is my strong opinion. But here's the easiest way to say this, right?
Okay.
The fact that there is a disparity in the science community about whether or not it's real is enough to.
It's very little.
Yep.
Very little disparity.
But,
most scientists, most the vast majority, agree that human beings are negatively affecting climate change.
Yeah.
The vast majority.
Yeah, I just don't think so.
You think that the very few scientists that disagree with the consensus are the ones that are correct?
Well, I think if something is it's either subjective or it's objective, and there are objective truths, right? But it's subjective if you're saying that there are some, and I don't think there's very little. There are some that don't get paid to go on TV. There's some that are not Bill Nye, who are not funded scientists, and that has been a whole...
Well, Bill Nye's not a scientist.
I know.
He's not. He's
it broke my heart when I found out.
A science...
mouthpiece.
Propagandist.
Yeah, but that's the point.
He's
and
a science. No, that's not a good word.
I don't think Al Gore is a scientist.
He's not.
Right.
But Bill Nye is a science influencer or a science entertainer.
Yeah, he's
But he doesn't have a background in actual science. He's not a scientist.
Right.
He doesn't have a PhD.
I learned about him in school. Everything I knew in science had to do with Bill Nye.
Well, he promotes science, and science is not bad.
Yeah.
But the real problem is with climate change is that, for sure, there has been ups and downs throughout the history of this planet. They're observable. They follow them in. I mean, it was one of the subjects that I had earlier today with Dr. Robert Schock. In 2014, the vast majority, 87% of scientists, said that human activity is driving global warming, yet only half the American public ascribed to that view. So,
well, what website is
87%,
this?
87%, and this is
Scientific American.
Yeah.
Yeah, .com, though. That means it's making money. I don't trust that. If it was a .org, I would probably take that, but this is just a random website, and
well,
I don't trust.
Well, Scientific American is not necessarily a random website.
I don't believe this at all, just so you know.
You don't believe it at all?
I genuinely don't believe it. I know you do, but I genuinely don't believe it.
Okay. All right. Now, this message is directly to Candace Owens, because you are one of the most popular and outspoken voices on the conservative side of all issues. That's your right. But what you should do is realize that the moment you start taking talking points from other people on the conservative side and the Koch brothers and all these other forums, that you can start spreading misinformation. I just want to give you one example. I can give you other examples, but just on this one. And if anyone in the audience can send this to Candace, please do. Candace, today 13 federal agencies which fall under Trump's watch agree that human activity is changing the climate for the worst and contributing to global warming. 18 independent scientific associations agree. There is no reliable foundation or association claiming to be truly scientific that disagrees. And this includes the Koch brother-run Heartland Institute, which is the primary source of climate denialism and most referred to by Trump administrators and Fox News and the people on Fox and Rush Limbaugh and the GOP legislators. They're all dead wrong on this. So among some of these associations that you should independently do your own homework and seek their advice, and I have their studies, because I'm just in the process now of producing the most comprehensive book and documentary ever produced on global warming and the climate. And I also was the author of Clearer, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, Blueprint for a New Environment, and the multi-award-winning documentary Saving the Planet 2 years ago, and Plant Codes this year. So it's not that there's a lack of quality information that is really scientifically based, but also it is our own experience. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, quote, "The scientific evidence is clear. Global climate change caused by human activities is occurring now and is at a growing threat to society." The American Chemical Society, quote, "Comprehensive scientific assessments of our current and potential future climates clearly indicate that climate change is real, largely attributable to emissions from human activities, and potentially a very serious problem." The American Geophysical Union, quote, "Human-induced climate change requires urgent action. Humanity is the major influence on the global climate change observed over the past 50 years. Rapid social responses can significantly lessen negative outcomes," end quote. The American Medical Association, which is concerned over how climate change will contribute to new pathogens and diseases and worsening existing health conditions, quote, "Our AMA supports the findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fourth assessment report and concurs with the scientific consensus that the Earth is undergoing adverse global climate change and that anthropogenic contributions are significant." The American Meteorological Society, quote, "It is clear from extensive scientific evidence that the dominant cause of the rapid change in climate for the past half century is human-induced increases in the amount of atmospheric greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, the chlorofluorocarbons, methane, and nitrous oxide." The American Physical Society, quote, "The evidence is incontrovertible. Global warming is occurring. If no mitigating actions are taken, significant disruptions in the Earth's physical and ecological systems, social systems, security, and human health are likely to occur. We must reduce emissions of greenhouse gases beginning now." Geological Society of America, quote, "The Geological Society of America concurs with assessments by the National Academy of Sciences, the National Research Council, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that global climate has warmed and that human activities, mainly greenhouse gas emissions, account for most of the warming since the mid-1900s. From the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, quote, "The scientific understanding of climate change is now sufficiently clear to justify taking steps to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere." The U.S. Global Change Research Program, quote, "The global warming of the past 50 years is due primarily to human-induced increases in heat-trapping gases. Human footprints also have been identified in many other aspects of climate change, including changes in ocean heat content, precipitation, atmospheric moisture, and Arctic sea ice." So, Candace, globally, not just in the United States, but both in the developed and underdeveloped world, 97% of scientists, based upon a review of the peer-reviewed publications, agree humans are contributing to climate change. Now, compared to the credentials of the naysayers who claim that they have the science to disprove climate change, they are like undergraduate amateurs in comparison to those who are adamant that humans are changing the course of the planet. Notably, and these are people that you should call or reach out to, Wallace Broker, Newberry Professor of Geology at the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences and the Earth Institute at Columbia University, research scientist at Columbia's Lamont Dottery Earth Observatory, and he's called the godfather of climate science. He pioneered the study of the history of the Earth's oceans since epochs ago and means of radiocarbon and isotope-based dating systems. James Hansen, former director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, where he spent a career spanning some 40 years, and he's currently adjunct professor at Columbia University and director of the Program on Climate Science Awareness and Solutions in Columbia's Earth Institute. And Manabe, Socorro Manabe, was the former director of the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and now heads Japan's Agency for Marine Earth Sciences and Technology. Susan Solomon is the Leanne Geraldine Martin Professor of Environmental Studies in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Planet Studies, MIT. Now, there is just simply too much chemistry, physics, to prove anthropogenic climate change is real to say that you don't believe it without doing your homework. That just shows pure bias. Do you want to be known as a person who could articulate, who could make an interesting presentation, all based upon your faith in the polemics around you instead of what is real? I am a scientist. Unlike Bill Nye, I'm an actual scientist. 33 years as research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, having done over 160 major experiments, some of which are really important, such as identifying for the first time that we needed no animal proteins to get all the amino acids, and published in peer-reviewed literature, etc. It's simply chemistry. When we burn carbon-based materials, carbon dioxide is emitted. This was discovered in the 19th century, and research began in the 1900s. We can simply measure the amount of CO2 and now methane in the atmosphere and trapped in ice to find that it is increasing at the levels are higher than anything we've seen in hundreds of thousands of years. And these measurements began back in the 1950s. This is not new. And starting in the early 1950s till today, chemical analysis has been consistently done on atmospheric CO2, and for 60 years has revealed the increases coming from burning fossil fuels. And basic high school physics that has been known since the 1820s, that CO2 absorbs heat. And since the 1930s, monitoring climate conditions have added over 80 years of data showing that recent warming of the Earth is correlated to and follows rising CO2 emissions. Therefore, only a complete denialist would fail to understand the simple science that CO2 keeps the Earth warmer than it would be without it, that humans are adding to CO2 and methane to the atmosphere mainly by burning fossil fuels or eating animal products because of the methane from these billions of animals on the Earth, and that's what's increasing the warming. The laws of physics tell us that without the atmosphere, the Earth would be approximately 59.4 degrees cooler than it actually is. If we add more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, the effect is like wrapping yourself in a thicker blanket. Even less heat is lost. And we know from bubbles of air trapped in ice cores that before the Industrial Revolution, the amount of CO2 in the air and atmosphere was about 280 parts per million. In 2013, NOAA, as Earth System Research Laboratory in Hawaii, announced that for the first time in thousands of years, the amount of CO2 in the air had gone over 400 parts per million. The conclusion, CO2 has increased by 43% in the last 150 years. So these are irrefutable facts. Greenhouse gas radiation is measured on the Earth's surface and in the atmosphere by using a specific wavelength on the spectrum. You can accurately measure a particular gas while filtering out the others. And this also measures the amount of radiation in the atmospheric greenhouse gases that's being radiated back to Earth by ozone and methane and nitrous oxide. So based upon these technologies, the concentration of CO2 as of 2016 is the highest in over 3 million years, long before the arrival of humans. All data shows that global averages are 1 degree Celsius warmer than in the mid-20th century. This is at the Earth's surface temperature. That is what we are concerned about, not whether it's hot or cold on any given day, whether there's rain or snow. Data shows that 11% of all greenhouse emissions is due to humans destroying the forest, largely the Amazon, where 1% of trees sequester 50% of carbon in the region. At this moment, 800 million people are directly vulnerable to climate change impacts. Droughts, floods, heat waves, extreme weather events, sea level rise. And so climate change denialers like yourself, Candace, have creatively come up with about 200 arguments to say why we shouldn't worry about the changing climate. But you're all wrong. the peer-reviewed literature shows you're wrong. And, well, the stupidest one that I've heard is equilibrium climate sensitivity, which tries to debunk the relationship between the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere with the levels of increase in temperature on the Earth's surface. Their argument is that this increase in carbon will only get very gradually raise the planet's warmth. Problem is that that model completely ignores water vapor and other gases in the atmosphere, and especially feedback loops. In other words, they ignore the grammar school physics that when something is hot, water evaporates, thus adding to greenhouse effects. So this is not meant to in any way degrade you. It's merely meant to allow you to know that step away for a moment. Walk away from trying to brand yourself as the new Ann Coulter. I think the world doesn't need another Ann Coulter. We didn't need the first one. Or the female version of Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity. We don't need that. All you're going to do is go down that rabbit hole. You'll be popular. You'll be famous all over the right and the conservative movement. And all the while, you'll be priding yourself in your ignorance. My hope is that you have the sensitivity and the character to reverse your position now. Oh, and by the way, the latest study on this is the current issue that just came out this week of Global Research. Dr. Andrew Glikson, quote, "Hothouse Earth, demise of the planetary life support system is now." And this was from the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, our most august body, saying that, quote, "We explore the risk that self-reinforcing feedback loops could push the Earth systems towards a planetary threshold that, if crossed, could prevent stabilization of the climate at intermediate temperature rises and cause continued warming on a hothouse Earth pathway, even as human emissions are reduced." So he's talking about something that's virtually apocalyptic. But take a look around you today. The worst fires in California history. The worst droughts, the hottest day, 136 degrees, just occurred this week. Are you going to say this didn't happen or that it was just one of those normal things? It's never happened, and it's not normal. Please, in the audience, see that Candace Owens, the new rising star of the right in conservative denialist philosophy of life, gets this message. Thank you. Now, something I was going to play earlier in the week but didn't have time is about how the people reacted fighting the Bayou Bridge pipeline. These are poor people, and yet they're adversely affected by the consequences of having a pipeline go right through their swamps, their wetlands, and they don't have advocates. Let us be their advocates. Let us be aware of their plight, and let's join together and try to help them. Here they are.
In 2016, a fierce indigenous-led movement emerged at Standing Rock. The world watched while a powerful oil company and police teamed up to unleash violence on protesters. Ultimately, the pipeline company won. Now, Energy Transfer Partners is extending that pipeline to Louisiana, and another resistance is brewing. This time, it's out in the swamps of Cajun country, across indigenous lands and waterways, and in communities of color. Waging war on big oil isn't easy, but people here are not going down without a fight.
Oil and gas is king in Louisiana.
We are going to fight every inch of this pipeline going in the ground in whatever way we can.
They're profiting off of our pain.
And my fight is clean water, clean soil, and clean air.
Activists here call the pipeline the Black Snake.
We call it, you know, kicking the snake in its.
We're driving across Louisiana to talk to people affected and see what they're doing to resist. Our first stop, Indian Bayou.
This is the land of refugees and survivors and thrivers.
I'm with Sharif Waitlin, who runs the Loi Labi protest camp, which means water is life. They travel to different locations to disrupt pipeline construction.
We're resisting one of the largest, like, Goliath-type beasts in the world, which is the oil and gas industry. it didn't start at Standing Rock, that people were fighting, especially indigenous people, indigenous mothers and grandmothers, have been fighting for ourselves and for this land and for the water and the safety of the people who live here for generations upon generations upon generations. Energy Transfer Partners has spilled every 11 days on average for the past 15 years.
The camp bought an 11-acre piece of land in the pipeline's path, which serves as its headquarters. The pipeline company was forced to change its plans and reroute around the camp because of the holdout. Protesters have had run-ins with police and pipeline security.
The intimidation has been pretty intense at times. There is some sort of shadowy group that's around that's in very dark tinted cars. I'd be in Piggly Wiggly and they'd be taking pictures of me and my kids, you know, shopping for food, or they'll be outside my house or whatever. They'll stop us and for a traffic ticket with their guns drawn. It's almost like they want to see something happen.
Just being at camp is pretty difficult. It's 98 degrees right now and oppressively humid.
So mosquitoes you got to worry about, because they will eat you up. Since colonization happened, indigenous peoples here in Louisiana, what is now called Louisiana, were pushed back further and further into the swamps. And not only did they find a way to thrive there, they also found a way to resist there. It is a gorgeous place, worth protecting, and there's so much more to protect. I worry about the idea that, you know, it's all gone, that it's all refineries and chemical plants, you know.
Our next stop is out in Cajun country, where a huge point of contention is the pipeline running through the Atchafalaya Basin, the biggest wetlands area in the United States. Many Cajun people, like Jody Mesh, depend on it to make a living. He's suing the Army Corps of Engineers for allowing ETP to come into the basin given the damage past pipelines have done.
These people make billions and billions of dollars, and there's no reason why they should destroy such a sensitive ecosystem and a sensitive world that we live in. You know what I mean? But I'm telling y'all, when I get a trap full of dead crawfish, that ain't no good. It's an indication of like the canary in the mine shaft.
Jody has been fishing here all his life. It was a trade that was passed down by his father and his grandfather before that.
What it's all about. You know, there's too much at stake. You know, there's people's livelihoods at stake. There's numerous species of fish and birds and, I mean, all types of marine animals that survive out here. The Cajun people and the Cajun way of life, we were born and we followed our parents and watched them do their living by fishing and making their way of life in the Atchafalaya Basin, you know, catching fish, crawfish, hunting stuff to eat. And you adapt to that way of life. You know, you're born into that.
A judge put a temporary halt on pipeline construction due to Jody's case. The ruling was appealed, and now construction is back on.
This is the newly cleared right-of-way for the Bayou Bridge pipeline. You know, I'm worried about the risk of a 20-inch oil pipeline potentially obstructing and leaking. Should that oil leak to a capacity that it spreads across these thousands of acres of critical habitat, I mean, you definitely have a major disaster.
Oil companies have changed the Atchafalaya Basin already. They clear large areas of trees and bore down into the swamp bottom. The excess dirt dams up certain areas and creates pockets of dead swamp where nothing can survive.
There's creatures that are relying on this water. It should have been better taken care of than what it was, and I want to make sure that it's done better in the future so we don't continue to lose areas like what we've lost. And none of those creatures, you know, can give interviews or can go to legislatures and cry out to, you know, the people who are supposed to be doing the job to represent the environment and represent the people and represent them.
Another issue which is all too real in Louisiana, flooding. Dredging has caused sediment buildup, and the basin now has less capacity to hold floodwaters.
The water, as it comes into the basin, it has to go higher up on the levee systems, putting our levee systems, which are not up to par, at greater risk of breaching or topping and flooding millions of people in countless communities. We're not opposed to the oil and gas industry. We're not opposed to your jobs and what, you know, your job being related to the oil and gas industry. We just know the job can be done better.
75 miles east, there's another waterway that could be seriously damaged. We're meeting with Monique Verdan, a tribal councilwoman for the Houma Nation.
This water body behind me, the Bayou Lafourche, provides over 300,000 people south of here with their drinking water, their bathing water, their everything water. This really is the lifeline for the United Houma Nation. You know, the Houma dodge the Trail of Tears by going deep into the delta, to the ends of the bayous, where they had everything they needed because they were able to provide for themselves. If the pipeline were to burst, or if there was to be an accident, that's not only the water for the Bayou Lafourche, that's the water for everybody in New Orleans, that's the water for everybody south of New Orleans.
Monique is part of a coalition of Indigenous women who focus on divestment. So they urge big banks to stop funding companies that build pipelines on sacred land.
When you look at this legacy of colonialism here, and then you follow the pipeline money, it leads back to Europe, to these big banks that are investing in these corporations.
At the end point of the pipeline, our final stop is the town of St. James, where residents are pushing back. Terry Joseph, who pastors a tiny Baptist church, is, like Jody, suing the pipeline company.
The Bayou River pipeline, you saw how they twisted and how they turned it, until it got to St. James through a lot of black areas, or through a lot of Hispanic areas, a lot of Indians. They ain't went through none of the white folk areas.
For years, oil and gas companies have run rampant on this low-income black community. People live with huge fuel tanks in their backyards. Refineries and pipelines are everywhere.
They need to move up the road somewhere and let people up there store their oil, because they ain't gonna get here. I'll make sure that we got enough tanks in there. We got 118 tanks. That's enough. But with the Bayou River pipeline, that means more tanks. That means more oil gonna be stored here. That means more leaks gonna be here. That means that more smells are gonna be here. You know, we got oil leaking now, and nobody wanna take the responsibility.
St. James is in the heart of Cancer Alley, a stretch of Louisiana with some of the highest rates of cancer in the country.
Eventually, if you stay here, you're going to die. My church is a family. I don't look at my members as my members. I look at them as my family, because we're very close. And one of my members is sickly. She got cancer. So that's why I'm involved, because when my people hurt, I hurt. When my people suffer, I suffer.
Previous pipeline companies have closed off a road that served as an evacuation route for part of the community. People worry if there was a leak or explosion, they would have no way out.
This is not a want. This is a need. We need an evacuation route. I'm going to fight. I'm going to do whatever I got to do. But I don't think we're going to overcome. Because once you let one in, and you let another one in, and you let another one in, and you let a Bayou River pipeline in, you didn't let too much come in already.
Louisiana already has over 50,000 miles of pipelines, and they're second only to Texas in refineries. While the industry props up their economy, they also have the most to lose to the effects of climate change, which is caused by these fossil fuel industries.
We lose a football field of land every 45 minutes in South Louisiana, and any land that goes underwater becomes property of the state, and the state leases it back to the oil and gas industry.
One-third of the nation's oil and gas is either being produced or transported via South Louisiana. But I always like to remind people that we're the best worst example. When it comes to poverty in America, we're at the top of the list. When it comes to quality education and healthcare, we're at the bottom of the list.
Louisiana has powered all of the United States to great sacrifice of ourselves. You know, we at this point are like a stage 4 lung cancer patient that's continuing to smoke. You know, it's time to make that change so that we are actually able to survive.
We need to become more aware of the Americans and others who are suffering here and around the world, educate ourselves, and then reach out through different activist groups and lend support for their cause. I'm Gary Nall. I'll be down in the bayou. I'll be filming these people and bringing their story to your attention in the next couple of months. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on the next program.
Never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no